0710, Chris's Health Gulf Coast v. Aetna, Inc.
May it please the Court, Mr. Clearman will present argument for the petitioner. Mr. Lipsky will present argument for the amicus, United States Department of Health and Human Services. Petitioner has reserved 4 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Clearman will open for the first 8 minutes and will present the argument.
Chief Justice Jefferson and members of the Court, we are here to try to undo the decision below, which found that we do not have jurisdiction to pursue a contract and statutory remedy statute given to us by the state of Texas. Our hospitals provide services and have entered into intermediary agreements with entities who provide Medicare. Those agreements are not subject to the Medicare Act and do not arise out of the Medicare Act, and the Court's conclusion that they do is erroneous.
Is there any possibility here that an MNC enrollee might have to pay some of these claims?
Your Honor, the contracts by statute require us to waive the right of recovery from the claimant.
But my understanding is that's unclear in this case. Now, help me with that.
Well, it's not. It may be unclear because the contract's not there, but it's not unclear in the statute. At 42 CFR 422.504G1, it provides that all contracts must have a waiver provision.
So if there were no Medicare coverage for one of these hospital claims, there's no way by law that the hospital can then charge the enrollee for that uncovered amount?
If the answer to that is not for anything covered by the Medicare Act, because it would have to go through the system.
But that begs
but if
the question.
They did something totally different that was unrelated to Medicare, then it would be a contract issue between that person and the hospital.
So coverage is an issue, could be an issue for an enrollee here.
Not for anything that is covered by the Medicare Act.
But
that wouldn't have been covered if they stayed in business.
Pardon?
I mean, that wouldn't have been covered if they
no,
been
no, 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 no. And the way this works is that the clean claims, as we've alleged, if I could just go back a little, we are obligated to prepare clean claims to present to the carriers. In this case, it went to NAM. Those are detailed explanations of what services have been provided that NAM can use for coverage and decides whether or not to pay it. It has 45 days to make that decision. Because NAM didn't have any money and went out of business, nobody ever looked at those claims. Now, the statute says that we cannot hold an enrollee liable. And without enrollee liability, there is no way for an administrative appeal to occur. And that is the essential answer here, is if you're looking at the scope of Medicare, there is no enrollee ability to engage in an appeal. And I would point the Court specifically to RenCare, which explains this in Part B, that if the enrollees are not liable, then the enrollee has no appeal rights. That's expressly stated at 42 CFR 422.562C. And in Part B of that same provision, it says that the only person who can appeal is the enrollee in the Medicare Plus Choice part of the Act. Now, furthermore,
how do we know this? What services were provided and whether they're covered by Medicare from this record?
Well, the question is whether they're covered by our contract with NAM, I would respectfully say.
Okay.
Because that's the issue.
And what does that contract show?
That contract has a...
Is that in the record?
We don't know what... I mean, to be honest, the 6,000 claims, they are in stacks this big, and nobody has ever said any of this is not covered or covered. Okay?
Which somebody could do at some point.
Well, the time to do that occurred way back when they were submitted to NAM. Under the prompt pay statute, they should go through these claims. Many are submitted electronically. And if it doesn't hit the bells and whistles to be covered, it should be paid. Or they can audit. They have a choice to say, we're going to audit you. They didn't do that.
But Aetna could argue, I suppose, that that time has not expired, and they can still look at the claims and say, okay, if we're responsible to pay, if we stand in NAM's shoes, then we pay this one, we don't pay this one, we pay this one.
That's an issue of the breach of the contract between NAM and the hospitals. And that is for the state court to decide. That is not an issue of the Medicare Act. And I'll show you, just if I may, that in RenCare, the two key decisions, that there is no arising under for claim. And the reason is no arising under the Medicare Act, which is the whole ballgame. If it arises under the Medicare Act, we don't have a remedy in state court or federal court for that matter, because we have to go through an administrative process. But under that section cited by RentCare is section 405H and G. And what is important about those is at the end of the Medicare review process, you can only sue the government for a claim, okay, in federal district court. So the point is there is no government interest in this case, and you can't just go sue the government for something it doesn't care about. So there is no avenue of review, which is what RentCare basically holds. There's no enrollee who cares about this claim anymore, because they have received the services that they are entitled to. They have waived their right to, or had the right of the hospital waived when they signed up for it. They're gone. To think that 6,000 people are going to show up and care about this issue is not going to happen.
Well, but again, my understanding is that the hospital can always go against them if the claims are determined not to be covered. But you're telling me that the time has passed to contest coverage.
Yes.
So all the claims are covered, and there's no right to go against the enrollees.
It is our belief under the federal statute and under the Texas Prompt Pay Act that the failure of NAM to do anything
okay.
in response to those claims.
But if you're wrong on that and there were an ability to go back and contest coverage, you'd agree that the Court of Appeals got this right? That the Court of Appeals got this right.
Not this Court of Appeals, no. The Fifth Circuit got it right. But if I may explain why. Let's assume we go against an individual for something that's not covered. Okay? It's not part of the Medicare Act anymore. Okay? If we did something that he wanted done that isn't part of the Medicare Act, by definition, we're stepping out of the Medicare shoes and into just a hospital shoe. Enrollee then says, I think that should have been covered. Okay? Next step. Enrollee files a petition with Aetna saying, I think you should have covered this claim. Then it goes to the administrative process, because what we have now is an enrollee who's interested in the claim, something we don't have within the Medicare issue.
But I anticipate they're going to argue that you have enrollees potentially interested in the claim, and as long as they're potentially interested in the claim, you have to exhaust administrative remedies.
You know, there is no administrative remedy to exhaust for these claims. Aetna has done a wonderful job that the Fifth Circuit completely rejected of realizing that these claims don't arise under the Medicare Act, and there just is nowhere for us to go.
But in RentCare, the contract itself said there will be no rights against enrollees.
And by statute, every contract has that same statement in it. Our contract either has it in it, or by law will be forced to have it in there, because we can't do business without that provision in the contract. Okay, I'm now going to sit down and let Mr. Litsky speak.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. I'm Isaac Litsky with the United States Department of Justice here on behalf of AMICUS, U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. If I may, I'd like to begin briefly with a few key points which I hope will help to clarify the issues before the Court. The first point, the Department of Health and Human Services administrative scheme at issue here exists for one purpose, to guarantee the rights of individual enrollees with respect to specific treatments and specific coverage issues. It's designed at every step of the way with that purpose in mind, and it can only properly function to that end. Second point I'd like to stress is this case did not originate as a dispute over coverage. This case originated when an insurer or an insuring entity went bankrupt, said we have no money to pay any and all claims, not because these 6,000 claims aren't defined by reference to, they don't all cover a specific treatment, and there isn't a contention that, you know, these 6,000 claims all for one treatment aren't covered. Or the way that we wrote these 6,000 claims came before the Court is because the entity went bankrupt and couldn't pay any claims. That leads to the third point, which is the critical point, which really is sort of at the core of the Department of Health and Human Services position here. We still do not have before us a bona fide coverage dispute. We have this theoretical contention that somewhere in these 6,000 treatments, somewhere in these 6,000 claims, there may be a claim for a service that is not covered under Medicare. That may be true. That's certainly not a reason to funnel these 6,000 claims through the Medicare administrative procedure. And in fact, we couldn't do so, even if we thought that made any sense, because the system's not designed to do that. And HHS is obviously bound by the congressional structure and by its own administrative scheme. The court has no questions. I also want to stress.
Well, let me, does it matter that we don't have the contracts and evidence? Does that in any way impact our decision here?
Yes, Your Honor, I think it does. I think it matters in the larger sense that, in many ways, I think this is an unfortunate case of sort of putting the cart before the horse. There are many issues to be resolved. The fundamental issues underlying this dispute are, where are those contracts? What do they say? Is there, under Texas state law, contractual liability? How does it flow from Aetna to NAMP? These are all the great questions that we need to have answered. Only when those questions are answered does there arise some potential liability, on Aetna's part. And only at that point would we turn to these 6,000 treatments, and someone in the first instance would have to look at them and make a coverage decision. And that's an important point, because that someone, it's not a mystery who that someone is. That someone is Aetna. There's no doubt that Aetna, the insurer, has in the first instance the obligation to take the claims presented to it, assess them, adjust them, look at the nature of its contract, look at Medicare coverage, and decide which claims it's going to, in good faith, pay promptly, and which claims it's going to contest, for which claims it's going to contest coverage. In fact, that's why Aetna exists. That's why Aetna has a contractual relationship with the United States government that's part of the services that Aetna provides to the United States government as a Part C provider.
And the hospital's position is it's too late to do that.
The hospital's position, as I understand it, Your Honor, is yes, it's too late at this point. But that's a state law. That's a state law argument. I believe their argument to be, and I'm probably the least qualified person to speak to it, but I will do so anyway. I believe their argument is under Texas prompt payment provisions, they had their chance. NAM, the entity, had their chance to deny coverage. They missed that opportunity. Aetna inherits their liability, so we don't even need to get into that process.
And your position in your brief is that even if even the prompt pay statutory requirement or regulatory requirement has to be informed by whatever the contract provisions are.
We don't take a position, Your Honor, on the interaction between the Texas prompt payment provisions and the administrative scheme mechanism. I can tell you this much. Should the day come, should this case go back to the lower courts, which we very much hope it will, should this case go back to the lower courts, and let's say, just for the sake of argument, the Texas prompt payment argument is rejected to the extent that the court deems Aetna should have an opportunity to process these claims. At that point, it's clear, again, the obligation would lie with Aetna in the first instance to look at these claims that were presented to it. Why it exists to do business as an insurer is to process these claims and to bear risk. And it would then look at those claims. We don't refute, we don't take the position that we put that in the positive. There may come a day where all these interesting myriad factual questions are resolved, where the Texas statutory prompt payment issues are resolved, and at some point we have to turn to this mountain of 6,000 claims. There may come that day, and there may be some subset of those 6,000 claims where there are actual bona fide coverage issues. At that point, it may be appropriate to turn to HHS and to invoke the administrative scheme.
But what would be wrong with starting with that process? You take all those contracts through the administrative process, quantify what you're covered or not covered then invoke statewide remedies.
Your Honor, proceeding in that manner, well, first and foremost, we couldn't invoke the administrative machinery to do that if we wanted to. But the reason why the administrative machinery is not to do that is because that would turn the review system on its head. In the average case, in the sort of standard case, you have an enrollee gets some treatment, submits a bill to his or her insurer, asks her.
So it would be more advisory without the enrollee there.
Well, yeah, it would be more advisory with the enrollee there, and it would be frankly, Your Honor, it would allow Aetna, the insurer, to shirk its responsibility of processing these claims. That's
Mr.
What
Litsky, there's 145 remaining.
Thank you, Your Honor. That's what these insurers do. It's you know, it's their business. They bear the risk and they engage in contractual you know, relationships, and they process the claims. And part of these Medicare Part C's insurers' obligations with respect to their contractual relationship with the United States is to process those claims. So you can't come to the Department of Health and Human Services and say, hey, do us a favor, be our claims department, because we have this big dispute and
it's not like the workers' comp system. This is just to decide disputes, not to.
That is exactly right. And in particular, it's to decide specific issues of coverage with respect to specific enrollees and specific treatments, not sort of general contractual issues. I do just want to stress briefly one point. Well, 2 points perhaps. The first is that the Heckler v. Ringer analysis is, in many senses, an unfortunate sort of red herring that's been interjected into this dispute. Heckler v. Ringer's arising under test bears on Section 405H, which governs suits brought against the United States, its agents or officers, HHS's secretary, et cetera, et cetera. Its provision, which preempts any action brought against the United States or its agents. And that's the arising under test is sort of meant to frustrate the efforts of people to creatively plead around that provision. This dispute is not an action against the United States or its agents. Respondents' contrary contention, frankly, is, with all due respect, just unequivocally wrong. In the Part A and B context, the United States is the insurer. It bears the risk. It provides the insurance service. It engages with true fiscal intermediaries, agents, which represent its interests, you know, do the actual contracting, do the actual running of these operations. But the risk is the United States, and the interest is the United States. Part C context is entirely different.
Your time has expired. Are there any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
The court is now ready to hear argument from the respondents.
May I please report, Mr. Sheely will present the argument for the respondents.
May it please the court, I'm John Sheely for the Aetna respondents. This court should affirm the dismissal of this case for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. Judge Yates, writing for the 14th Court of Appeals, affirmed Judge Wilson from Harris County's decision to say that the providers must exhaust their administrative remedies.
Tell me what that exhaustion would look like.
I can tell you exactly what it would look like, Judge. And what's in this folder here is they, after the trial court, they started writing letters to us to try to exhaust. That's not in the record because it happened after the trial court. But let me tell you how it would normally work, Judge. The organization determination, let's figure out what that is. That's any determination made by the M plus C organization, that's Aetna, with respect to any of the following. The M plus C's organization refusal to provide or pay for services in whole or in part, including the type of level of services that the enrollee believes should be furnished or arranged by.
But doesn't that contemplate an enrollee engaged in the administrative process?
It could include an enrollee, but this says including. And we can just put to rest right now the notion that the regulations do not provide for the providers to have an organization determination on their behalf. I cite to you 422-566-5C, which says, who can request an organization determination? The enrollee, including his or her authorized representative, and what is second, cited by the Court of Appeals, any provider that furnishes or intends to furnish services to the enrollee.
But this doesn't seem to make much sense. How the hospital is going to go to the federal agency, administrative law judge, and say, this claim and this claim and this claim and this claim are all covered. And you're going to say, that's right.
Well,
and then this claim and this claim and this claim and this claim are all covered.
Let's remember what we heard about what the contracts are in this case. Aetna has a contract with HCFA. It delegated, as the Medicare statute allows, the risk to NAM. NAM contracted separately with the hospitals. Now, you heard that supposedly this contract has to keep the enrollees indemnified and safe. They pled that they didn't have a contract, that they had letter agreements with NAM, and I refer you to the record.
Well, you're beside my question. My question is, what is the agency going to decide? They're going to decide, you want them to decide, are the claims covered or not?
Aetna is an agent, an employee of the federal government for purposes of its role in this process. So the claims came into NAM. They say that there was no response.
I'm going to ask you. I have a very specific question.
Yes, Judge.
And the question is, what is the ALJ going to decide?
He's going to decide.
What's he going to say in his findings and conclusions?
He is going to look at 6,000 claims and determine whether or not those were covered Medicare services.
But that doesn't make any sense, because it looks like the presumption has to be the other way. They're covered until somebody says they're not covered.
No, Judge, it's their burden to show, of course, that there is a covered service if they're going to submit a claim with an assignment, presumably from Medicare enrollee Sally Smith.
And vis-a-vis the government, isn't it Aetna's burden to prove that there's not a covered claim?
It is the plaintiff's burden to prove that the claims that they're submitting for payment.
I guess what I'm saying, though, is prove to whom? Because Aetna is the adjuster.
It comes through Aetna. Thereafter, they are entitled to ask for reconsideration, which after the trial court, they did to Aetna. Then Aetna sends it, and the scheme goes, and they've done it for review by an independent organization that contracted with Medicare. That's Maximus Cheddar. That's where the claims are.
Surely the HMO pays claims ordinarily without having a federal hearing on whether they're covered or not. You just agree to pay them.
Well, no, the fact that there are 6,000 here, it was the choice of the hospital to bundle those together. But normally every claim comes in. In this instance, NAM, who had the risk, paid claims for a while, covered claims.
And they didn't send them to the federal agency for a determination of coverage.
Well, we don't know whether there were any that went up there or not. If they were covered, they were paid. At some point, as they say, NAM didn't respond to any of the claims. That in itself is an organization determination under the rules. And I cite to you 422-568F. Let's listen to it. Effect of failure to timely provide notice. If the M plus C organization fails to provide the enrollee with timely notice of an organization determination as specified in this section, this failure itself constitutes an adverse organization determination and may be appealed. So if they didn't hear from NAM, as they say, then their next step was to go and appeal. They would appeal to Aetna. Aetna would look at it. If it had paid it, they would have. If it was covered, it would have been paid. If they don't like the determination made by Aetna, then they go to the next level, which is an outfit called Maximus Cheddar, not affiliated with Aetna, which is contracted with HCFA. That's where the claims are looked at.
Do you agree with Mr. Clearman that Christus expressly waived its right to seek payment?
Absolutely not, Your Honor, and I cite to you in the record 182.
Does the statute require that the contracts have that provision?
If they had had a HCFA-approved contract with the hospitals, then the regulation requires that indemnity clause to be there. They did not. They pled that they were operating under letter agreements.
And I interrupted you. You were going to give me a
record. I'm going to give you a cite, Judge. This is the letter at 181 in the record. At page 182, this is when the hospitals wrote HCFA. And so we want you to order Aetna to pay this. Footnote 3, they preserved their rights to assert any and all claims against NileCare 65 as non-contract providers. And they say later in the letter that they'd hate to have to go after the enrollees, but they were keeping that issue open. So the record absolutely does not support that the hospitals will not go after the individual enrollees. And the reason, what we need to determine, is are the claims covered? Once you know what the claims are covered through the administrative procedure, which the regulations and statute lay out in.
But ordinarily, someone has to deny coverage before it goes to hearing.
That's what has happened, Your Honor, by the effect of failure to provide an organization determination.
They just went broke. They didn't say these aren't covered. They just
that's not correct either. In the record, in their sworn proof, you can see that some of their complaints are for underpaid claims. Underpaid claims. So there had to have been an organization determination. That's what the record reflects. And so there is a group of 6,000 claims which they claim are covered. They have presented them to NAM. They say NAM didn't pay. NAM's, in their words, failure to respond is an organization determination. They had the right to appeal. They decided to file a lawsuit a couple years later, but they had the right.
But your position is, even if NAM didn't pay the claim for a reason that had nothing to do with coverage, just because they didn't have the money, even if that's the case, it still has to go to the agency for approval.
Yes, it does. And the reason for that is because you can spend a lot of time in the details of the regulation. This is Medicare money. Medicare is going to determine what is covered. Why is that important?
But why did they even contract with Aetna in the first place?
Well, in 1997, Congress decided that when they passed Medicare Plus C, that it would make sense to be able to contract with HMOs or managed care organizations such that Medicare beneficiaries would have a wider range of choices than Parts A and B.
I understand that, but I mean it was also so that surely the governmental intent was that Aetna adjust those claims and determine coverage issues.
Well, no, they specifically...
And then Aetna just sort of contracted that further down.
Well, no, the regulations specifically allow Aetna to delegate the risk to these...
But that doesn't
answer
the question of the government's delegation to Aetna to adjust these claims. And it seems to me that Aetna's trying to put the adjustment onus on the government.
Aetna is in the first, layer, if you will, of review. That's what happened. There was an adverse determination. They since submitted the claim. We know that from their pleading. They say that they submitted the claim to Aetna and Aetna refused to pay. We know this is about unpaid claims. They say that their damages are precisely the amount of these unpaid claims.
But the question is, why? Are they?
Why?
It seems to make a difference why they weren't paid. They're not paid because they're covered, not covered. Well, then, yes, coverage has to be decided. But if they're not paid because somebody won't write a check, that's just a different matter.
Well, in any contract case, you need to prove that here's my claim, it's valid, please pay me. They have not done that.
Well, in most contract cases, you have the contracts as well.
Again, their burden to put them in. The reason they didn't, I submit, is they didn't have the contract with HCFA. The indemnity language is not there. Their pleading establishes that they had a variety of, quote, letter arrangements. Aetna paid every dime it owed to NAM. There's no windfall here for Aetna. They contracted hard, the hospitals, with NAM for 3 years. That's what their pleading says. And they push and they push for higher rates. They're the ones that had the arrangement with NAM. And if NAM didn't have money left or got run out of business, they're the parties who contracted with them, not Aetna.
And that may be true, but I just don't see what it has to do with a federal agency determination.
Aetna, Your Honor, is the equivalent of the federal government in its role in the Medicare statute. I would cite to you the cases, the Marsaw case in our briefing, the Life Care case, the Foley case. You practice long enough, once in a while you win a case. The Foley case that's actually reported. I represented Aetna in the Foley case. NAM was the intermediary. They admit below at 174 of their record that if LifeCare, that LifeCare and Foley support the decision of the trial court. So their only basis to try to get around that ruling and that admission here is to say that RenCare changed the world, and it did not. And the reason is RenCare was what Judge Yates referred to as, at most, a pure payment dispute. There, the difference is there was a contract with the HMO. There was a contract with RenCare. They had a contract. We don't have that here. The coverage was agreed to. There was no dispute, and it was how much. That's why RenCare is different. Now, procedurally, it's much different because it was a complete preemption case, i.e., in this case, be removed to federal court. And the court said, no, it isn't. We're not going to find an exception like we do for ERISA and the Labor Management Relations Act. Once it decided that was the jurisdictional issue, its comments, if you will, are, in the words of the Fifth Circuit, void and can be ignored once there's no jurisdiction. But even getting beyond that, the hospitals have no contract with Aetna. Coverage is in dispute. We know that because the prompt pay statute that they claim to be suing under, as Judge Yates pointed out, says that we're not liable under that for covered services. We got to determine coverage first, even for them to proceed. Why does that make sense?
Let me just be sure. You said coverage is disputed, but is it actually disputed about any particular claim?
Yes, Judge. And the record would show where they claimed that there were underpayments of claims.
But was the underpayment because they ran out of money or because they...
It's not in the record as to why. They have argued that NAM just ran out of money. That's not been shown at all. It's not been shown at all. For all we know, NAM had them all lined up and was ready to issue them and had processed them, didn't get the checks out and ran out. But they were the party with...
Does it matter under your construction of the rules, though, where no ruling is a default?
It does not matter, Your Honor.
A denial?
No ruling means it's a denial.
If they don't get the money, it's a denial.
Absolutely.
Under the rules.
And under their theory, at 45 days plus 14 on the reg that I read, they had the obligation to start the exhaustion process for their administrative remedies.
Did it matter if they had a contract or not, if the default provision under the rule is it's a denial?
Not as an organization term.
They still have to go back.
Absolutely, they have to go up. And they don't have any cases that say they don't. We have cases that say you do. The only thing they can say is, well, the RenCare case in the Fifth Circuit. That's really when it comes down to all that they have. And in the end, that case is easily distinguishable. It, with all due respect to Fifth Circuit, ignored the regulations, which we've cited in our brief, which show that providers are a part of the exhaustion process, that they have the right to be.
Just coming back to the first series of questions, say they have to go. You get to the ALJ and
yes.
Says, well, what are we here upon? And so, well, this is Sally Jones' claim. And
one of 6,000.
One of 6,000, number one. So get ready. And, okay, is there any dispute about Sally Jones' claim? And Aetna said, no, we don't dispute that. So, okay, why are we here? And what's the answer to that?
Well, if there was no dispute about the coverage claim, it did come through Aetna, then it wouldn't have gone up. They have not established coverage as to any of the 6,000.
I know,
claims.
But they go in, they say, we want to establish. So here's our first claim, Sally Jones. Well, what'd you do?
Well,
this treatment, is it covered or not? Well, what does that say? Well, we don't dispute the right.
Well, let's say that happens, Judge. Then that means that's one less claim to come back to and deal with in the court system once the exhaustion process is completed, which, of course, is one of the overarching reasons for having exhaustion of administrative remedies. It will narrow the scope of the claims that a court needs to look at.
But the agency says we're not here to do that. We're here to decide disputes. There needs to be a dispute before you get here.
Well, I understand that the agency says they don't want to look at 6,000 claims. That much I understand. But they're stuck with these. All right? They're stuck with the regulations. And
So who would if I understand your theory, you're saying hospitals present their claims to NAM. NAM doesn't pay them. That's a denial. The hospital should have filed an administrative proceeding.
Should have asked Aetna to reconsider.
Okay.
Within the time periods allowed by the regulation.
And since those times have passed, we can consider that denied too.
Yes.
And so they file a claim in administrative court saying they should have paid it. And would the administrative judge say NAM has to pay it or Aetna?
Well, that's a good question, Judge. I think that since they've sued us, we would be there. But the only step before you get to the ALJ is a request for reconsideration, and then it is sent to an independent agency contracted by HCFA. That's called Maximus. That's where the claims, when they last were exhausting their administrative remedies after the trial court, that's where the claims are. But what the ALJ would say, they would go and say, managed care organization, Aetna, do you agree with coverage? We either do or we don't, and there's one claim less to do or not. But it would be, NAM could be a party. They could sue NAM in state court if they wanted to. They just decided to go where they thought the money was. But the administrative process would be the M plus C organization, or Aetna, would be the party, if you will, who is responding to the claims of the hospitals that they provided services to Medicare enrollees and have submitted claims in support. And if it's one claim or 6,000, you need to show coverage. That is their burden. They have not done so. They haven't asked them on reply where they are in their exhaustion, because they certainly sent them in after the trial court. You could make the argument that they were late, but Aetna didn't do that, and they sent them on to Maximus. So that's where they stand. Aetna has, that's the way it's supposed to be. If depending on what Maximus determines, then they will go to the ALJ. After the ALJ, it could eventually go for judicial review. Again, the overriding reason is we want Medicare recipients around the country to be treated equally. That's why the Medicare administrative scheme makes sense, so that people in Florida and Texas and Maine presumably...
The U.S. Department is presumably has analysis that would apply to all the states. Is there any deference that we should pay to their assessment of this?
Not in this instance, with all due respect, Your Honor. And the reason for that is they are not allowed under the Central Laborers versus Hines case, United States Supreme Court, to say that we actually have been doing this a lot different than what the regulations or law require. That is in our brief. And additionally, the case has established that the most authoritative rule, it's not what HCHS says they want today, what Congress told them to do, and that's what these regulations say. And they cannot say below, the only argument of the hospitals was only enrollees can use the administrative process. That's definitively wrong under the regulations. So they've kind of morphed it now and said, well, we really don't want to have to do that. It seems hard. It seems like there are a lot of claims. The fact of the matter is there is a procedure in place. It's occurred here. It's at least partway through. It is designed to keep from courts having to look at, with all due respect, 6,000 claims from the get-go. Once that happens, once the process is exhausted, coverage is determined, and then we can come back and they make their claim, maybe put their contracts in the record, and any defenses can be asserted then. But the cart before the horse is not knowing what you're going to have in front of the court as to claims, and you need to determine coverage. That links up in some ways with the prompt pay statute. Let's say this was just a regular old insurance contract, and they wanted to sue for prompt pay. Well, they'd have to prove that the claims that were submitted were in fact clean, and there's no evidence. They say that, but there's no evidence that these were clean claims that were submitted. And then they would have to show that it was covered. Because if it's not covered, it's an absolute defense. I see my time is short for the reasons contained in our brief and the regulations passed that need to be followed. The Aetna request that the judgment of the Court of Appeals be affirmed in its entirety. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel.
You know, if I may, Justice Heck, you've hit probably the key point of common sense in this entire thing. In the court below, coverage was not even alleged to be an issue. That was an issue that was created by the Court of Appeals. And if you go back and look at the record in our brief, we point that out. Below, Aetna said that it had fully complied with its obligations to fund NAM, and it said NAM breached the contract by failing to pay the hospital for covered claims. Now, 6,000 claims that are submitted by computer include things like coughing, hurt fingers, and they ask that you just assume that they have to go through 6,000 of these. This is just the best game known to man to avoid paying.
What is your best response to the argument that no ruling is tantamount to a denial of coverage?
Well, the first thing is that in the instance of an enrollee's interest, and you go back to the law, and it always says an enrollee's belief should be paid. It is a case that if the entity does not respond to the enrollee's request, that can be deemed a denial. But the entire statute looks to the enrollee. Now, there are times when a doctor can do it on behalf of a patient who he believes needs immediate care or something like that. But it always occurs
before.
So
hospitals usually take an assignment from the enrollees, so your submission is on behalf of or in the shoes of the enrollee?
Well, as the court points out in RenCare, the assignment exists. All hospitals get assignments. But that's not what we're suing on. Our suit is against...
No, but we're talking about submission for payment to NAM. I thought that... Don't you have... When you submit, don't you have to have an assignment from the enrollee in order to submit on their behalf?
No.
Do you have one?
I'm sure we do.
And so was your submission pursuant to the enrollee's rights?
No. Our submission was pursuant to our contractual obligation with NAM to provide Medicare enrollees services. That is our contract. That is why the federal government won't have anything to do with this. And I point out at the real important
point. Let me stop you just a minute. Do you have a contract?
Yes.
You're not just depending on letter agreements.
Well, we have contracts that are extended by letter agreements, and that is pled in the record.
Okay.
But let me tell you why, at the jurisdictional issue we're at right now, we pled we had a contract, should have put it in the record. You're right. You would have put the issue to rest. But we pled that we also had claims, which means that we submitted claims that were to be paid, and we pled that they just refused to pay because they didn't have the money. Under Texas statute, Aetna, under the prompt pay, remains liable to us until it pays.
And what is your position in response to counsel's statement that the regulations, in fact, allow the provider to appeal a refusal to pay?
Well, if you look, my response would be to look at the decision in RingCare and the statutes that apply, which talk about enrollee interest. It has to be.
What is the language? Let me ask you this. What is your position on the, what is the language in the regulation? Does it include providers?
In certain instances, but not one that applies here. Okay. The Aetna's, let me get to this last point, which is very important. Aetna has to be the federal government in this case to win this case, and that's why they say it in their brief. Contrary to the silly fact that the federal government's actually sitting over here. The reason is that this case only goes down to 405 G and H, which are the only provisions in statute to say you have to have this suit go through an administrative process in federal court. That's why they say Texas courts don't have jurisdiction. That statute requires the federal government to be the defendant. Aetna is the defendant here. It's the risk-bearing entity. It's Part C, not A or B. And all of the cases that they try to say that they're the government are under A and B.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Clearman. The cause is submitted, and the court will take another brief recess.